It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRX. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Do you remember where you were the day of the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh?
The testimony was going to start, I don't remember, 9:30, 10.
This is journalist Rebecca Traister. And warning, we're going to revisit a bit of that day.
I dropped my kid off at elementary school. This is about an hour beforehand. I bumped into a woman that I knew in the schoolyard. She caught my eye and we stopped and were like, oh my God. A group of other women had joined us, women I didn't know well. Several of them were crying, maybe including me.
We have before us today two human beings, Dr. Ford and Judge Kavanaugh.
We knew we were gonna have to go watch this display.
I am here because I believe it is my civic duty to tell you what happened to me while Brett Kavanaugh and I were in high school.
Of a woman and her experience of pain and assault. Watching her performance as if you were watching, like, an Olympic sport, like a gymnastics competition. Does she keep her balance? Does she wobble?
With what degree of certainty do you believe Brett Kavanaugh assaulted you?
Is she gonna stick the landing? Do you know what I mean? That, like, sitting there with your breath held.
100%.
I was so glad that she was being quiet.
Indelible in the hippocampus is the laughter.
Her care in not being angry.
The uproarious laughter between the two.
Her care in keeping her voice steady.
And they're having fun at my expense.
Each of you deserves to be treated fairly. It's important that we treat Judge Kavanaugh fairly now.
Those same men had discussed the women protesters who were in the room, yelling and holding up signs.
This is a national disgrace.
Ben Sasse had called those protests a form of hysteria.
We could have had this conversation in private in a way that didn't not only do crap to his family, but do all... I yield my time.
Orrin Hatch.
The search for truth has to involve more than bare assertions.
Had said of a woman who'd gotten up and yelled that if health care reform were repealed, she would die. Orrin Hatch had said, get this loudmouth out of here.
He was an immature high schooler.
Loudmouth.
So were we all.
There was no room for Christine Blasey Ford to be angry, though she had every reason in the world to be angry. We knew that she couldn't be, because we all have had that experience of, in a meeting or in a relationship, knowing we have to keep our voice steady. If we betray too much of what we're feeling, it's going to hurt us.
You may defeat me in the final vote, but you'll never get me to quit. Never.
My God, thinking about this makes me upset, actually.
Me too. Here's what I remember. I was at work that day, watching the hearings in bits and pieces, and as the day wore on, I noticed that all the women at work were having a much harder time with it than the men. I mean, the men were upset too, but the women. The women would catch each other's eyes in meetings and say, are you doing okay? We'd pass each other in the hall and stop for just a minute and say, hey, how are you? It was like this coded acknowledgement that we all felt physically in our bodies, anxious, sick, tense. And also, this was somehow so familiar. Reading Rebecca Traister's new book on women's anger has helped me understand why.
One of my political heroes, Barbara Lee, the congresswoman from California, she's been working for 17 years to repeal the authorization for the use of military force, which was passed in the days after September 11th, 2001. It enables the president to go to war without congressional approval. It's been used over 37 times. She's been working on it tirelessly. She finally got bipartisan support for the repeal, and then Paul Ryan pulled out the repeal out of the appropriations bill in the middle of the night. And she had to go into a meeting to protest the stripping of this repeal. And the meeting was with a Republican congressional leader named Pete Sessions from Texas. And she had to sit there in that chamber with every reason in the world to be livid. And that as an African-American woman, she describes having to keep her voice steady because she knew if she showed her anger, she'd be just that angry black lady. As this man condescended to her and told her, well, it's just the way things work. And she had to be calm and collected in the amount of effort it took. And she describes how afterwards some of her white peers said, oh, you really held it together, Barbara. And that made her even angrier because she said, you don't know how hard it was. You don't know what I had to do to keep it together. We have all done this. This is our daily life.
Isn't that ironic, given that one of the mantras of first or second wave feminism was the personal is political?
It's ironic, but it's also strategic. There's a reason that women's anger is discouraged. There's a reason that the anger of people of color is discouraged. There's a strategy there, because if you discourage the expression of anger, if you censure it, then the people whose anger is censured are more likely to bottle it up. In fact, I write in the book about the prices that you can pay if you go and yell, and they're steep. You can lose your job. You get a reputation for being difficult. You lose your promotion. Or a woman of color is pulled over for no reason and she gets angry at that arresting officer, she winds up in jail or shot.
And yet, you've written a book suggesting we should get angry and we should own our anger and express it and get a lot more comfortable with it. Why? When the costs are clearly so high.
Well, let me say this. The book is not suggesting that anybody get angry or express their anger differently. It's interesting because I do think that that is how a lot of people hear it.
You called it good and mad. Suggesting being mad is good.
Yes, but that's different from suggesting that we all go out and get angry. So I'm not telling anybody go out and rage. I'm telling you listen to the rage around you and start to hear it and value it differently and listen to the ways in which it's written off and marginalized when perhaps it shouldn't be.
But I think that almost every political or social movement grows out of anger about some kind of injustice. So what's different about women's anger?
Well, so many of the social and political movements that have transformed this country are movements that did find their spark in anger at inequality and injustice, often women's anger at inequality and injustice. However, because we are so actively and steadily discouraged from appreciating or even acknowledging women's anger as politically consequential, the source of so much of that energy behind those social movements has been obscured for us because we haven't been taught to look at and appreciate that anger coming from women as having been the fuel, as having been the catalytic spark. And those messages mean that we don't value women's anger.
Right. And we're socialized to that. But I guess it's somehow it's a jump from saying that's part of our social culture, how we were raised, to say that it's systematic suppression.
Well, you know, it's not like there's one, you know, Mr. Evil flying around a plane being like, we're going to suppress the anger of women. You know, it's not like that. It's not how it works. But the views we get in popular culture of women's voices very rarely raised in anger in a way that we're supposed to understand as heroic or rational or valid. That's not true for white men. White men's voices raised in anger, we see in pop culture all the time as powerful, strong, impassioned. We see it in our politics all the time. One of the reasons Bernie Sanders was a terrific candidate was because he could channel the anger of his supporters. He could shake his fist and yell and be gruff about inequality, and a stadium would cheer for him for good reason, because he was being righteously angry about injustice.
What about black women candidates? Because there's that trope of the angry black woman.
Right. Two things tend to happen around black women's anger. Some of the women's anger gets celebrated as funny. Say Maxine Waters. Maxine Waters, whose party has been in the minority, who's been very frank and very furious, she fundamentally doesn't have power. And so her anger can be turned into a kind of entertainment. People use memes and GIFs of black women expressing anger as a way to express their own anger. And often it's white people doing this. And this has been referred to as digital blackface. And it's also, of course, making black women do the work of expressing anger
for white women who are not risking the censure of expressing anger themselves, right?
And then in turn, turning them into a stereotype that's kind of a put down.
Exactly. So it's the use of Maxine Waters looking over her glasses. There are a million versions of this. Throwing the match on the car from Waiting to Exhale. Dorothy Height giving side eye during Martin Luther King's speech in the March on Washington. And so there's a way in which the trope of the angry black woman has been turned into this cartoon, this sort of neck snapping sapphire cartoon of the angry black woman. But let me say this, when black women do present a threat, when their anger does seem like it might be attached to the power to displace something white male, then that anger stops being a cartoon and becomes framed as violent, threatening, militaristic. And there's no clearer example of that than Michelle Obama. Going through the 2008 campaign, Michelle Obama, who is so charismatic, funny, thoughtful about her husband and about politics and about history, she became presented as such a violent threat. She wound up being caricatured on The New Yorker as, you know, a black power figure. And remember when she and Barack Obama did the dap after winning, you know, they did a fist bump.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it was described, it must have been on Fox News, as a terrorist fist jab.
I was thinking maybe instead of anger management classes, we all need anger skills classes. Like for women to excavate and figure out how to channel anger in ways that will be productive, how do we begin to do that?
Well, in part, I think that we've seen some of this begin to happen around politics in the past couple years. After the 2016 election, that anger that many of us usually take care to push down or keep quiet or not be disruptive poured out. And some things happened when it came out. A lot of women who'd been angry and thought they were isolated, alone, that this was a feeling that they should feel shame about or be quiet about or that it made them weird, got angry and realized that there was a woman who lived down the block who was angry about the same things. But because they'd been taking all this care to not express their anger, they never knew they were angry about the same things. But then when it came out of us, they found each other. And within political terms, that's what has led to a lot of the organizing that we've seen happen. Women suddenly talking, and what can we do? And we'll join an indivisible chapter, or we'll make our own group, or we'll go to the protest together on Sunday, or we should find somebody who's running for office, or I should run for office. Will you help me? Yes, I'll be your campaign manager. But we've seen the natural sort of channeling of it into political activism. There's this Amanda Littman who co-founded an organization called Run for Something that draws young candidates under 40 into politics, first-time candidates. She says, anger is my cup of coffee in the morning. I don't feel shame about my anger. Anger is what drives me out to do my work. She's also told me that anger is great in candidates because anger is what drives candidates out the door to knock doors and pound pavement. Anger can be a tremendous personal fuel.
It's so interesting because we do tend to code anger as toxic somehow. You know, even if it can accomplish things, we think of it as this thing that is uncomfortable to feel. But you wrote that while you were doing the research for the book and while you were writing it and feeling all that anger, you felt better than you had in a long time, like physically even.
Oh, yes. That is absolutely true. I worry every time I talk about this that somebody's going to take it as a health tip, right? Like the new. And that is not. In fact, I was being paid to be angry and to think about anger. And I did feel great. I slept well. I wanted naturally to exercise more. I ate well. You know, it was a period where I had great sex life with my husband. Like it was a period of great mental clarity and good physical health. But that's
how
not
do you,
something.
How do you explain that?
It was just that nobody was telling me that a part of how I rationally feel every day was invalid. In fact, they were valuing this part that we're often told to stuff down. Many of us are made to feel that the anger that we feel is a kind of perversion, a toxic perversion, that it's bad that we feel that way. I was told by my dentist when I was writing this book, angers the women who are angry. Oh, the women are angry and it's bad. They're grinding their teeth. We're regularly told that anger brings us high blood pressure and depression. And by the way, I'm not saying that that's not true, but part of what I think might be causing the teeth grinding and the depression and the high blood pressure is the strain of keeping it in.
Yeah.
As if this anger that we feel is an invalid part of our natural, valid, reasonable response to the world and its injustices.
So tell me what it looks like for a woman to own anger, to not repress it. without necessarily, you know, boiling over all the time.
I hear from women, having been on book tour this fall, been to many cities, spoken to hundreds and hundreds of women and men, I've heard from so many of them that the expression of anger via political engagement has been rewarding and transformative for them. I listen to women regularly, especially women who have previously not been civically engaged, especially suburban white women who'd lived in perhaps red communities where they might have voted Democratic, but they never even put so much as a lawn sign out because they didn't want to be the skunk at the party. They didn't want to be the disruptive, angry force. And then in the wake of Donald Trump's election, they got furious and sort of bubbled over and became engaged in activist politics, whether that meant engaging in protest, running for office, working for candidates running for office, participating in some of the strikes, the teacher strikes, or getting involved via the hashtag MeToo movement, telling stories and listening to stories of harassment and assault. I hear women regularly tell me that they feel personally transformed, that they're different people. They use the language of coming out in ways that they say are good, that they feel like new people. A woman in St. Louis told me a few weeks ago, she said, I feel like men have had their perspectives on the world changed and that women's worlds have changed. I've heard women using language that I write in the book reminds me a little bit of Thelma and Louise saying, we're never going back. Something's crossed over in us.
Okay, then, let's not get caught. What are you talking about? Let's keep going.
Rebecca Traister. She's a journalist and author of the new book, Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. And speaking of the uses of anger, she's not the only one finding satisfaction in some red-hot rage. Kristen Conger and Caroline Irvin are the hosts and founders of Unladylike, which is a podcast, media company, and now a book, with the subtitle, A Field Guide to Smashing the Patriarchy and Claiming Your Space. So, what makes them mad?
Not being taken seriously. And having people who are less qualified than we are being taken more seriously.
Yeah, and having our emotions downplayed.
You're slowly and systematically being driven out of your mind.
Why?
BS arguments about, women are inherently inferior.
Or you're just being hysterical.
Yeah.
Don't look at me like that.
Please stop being hysterical.
Girls, I think from an early age, are conditioned to assume that they might just be making it up.
It began with her imagining things, that she heard voices.
They might just be dramatic. It might just be their hormones.
And then the voices began to speak.
It's gaslighting.
Right, because it not only causes you to question yourself, but in the process, it silences you.
And in the end, she died in an asylum with no brain at all.
Because suddenly, you're internalizing all the questions and interrogating yourself rather than, you know, interrogating what you were originally angry about. I mean, it's so supremely minimizing.
Now, sit down and calm yourself before they come.
Years ago, when Caroline and I were first working together, we were hosting another podcast called Stuff Mom Never Told You, where we were really first starting to dive into feminism and gender and women's history. We had been kind of preaching to our listeners to know your worth and dispelling gender wage gap myths.
I hope you're not starting to imagine things again.
And then it came time for me to renegotiate my contract. And I knew walking into that situation that I was not making as much as my male coworkers.
Are you becoming suspicious?
When I brought that up, I was gaslit.
All these years you worked so hard and now what's come over you?
I was told that I shouldn't even really be talking about that.
You've been forgetful lately.
Even though I knew in my head,
losing things,
and had been telling other women for years, like, know your worth and stand up for yourself.
You get tired.
Yes, that's probably what it is. I get tired.
The gaslighting worked on me.
mind is going.
It shut me down because I felt like I had brought up something that I shouldn't, that I had asked for something that I should not have, that I was being too difficult. And I ended up taking the final offer.
I hope to find you better in the morning.
And it's honestly kind of haunted me because it was a split second where I couldn't take my own advice and kind of undermined my own worth. I've honestly thought about that a lot ever since. I wish that in that moment I had simply asked the question, why is that a problem?
Why indeed?
And to continue to ask it.
Yeah, I mean, because that was my genuine question at the time of like, wait, why? What? Hold on. And it's the question I still have.
But all of that is ultimately what inspired us and pushed us to go out on our own and start Unladylike Media.
We did get angry. We did get angry enough to finally say, you know what? Screw it. Let's do this. Let's go independent and make our own things.
All by yourself?
Yes, all by myself.
Oh, but is that wise?
We should also note that that was a years-long process. It was not like waking up one morning and being like, and today we're going to smash the patriarchy once and for all.
And rejoicing in my heart without a shred of pity, without a shred of regret.
Ragepiration is essentially productive rage. A combination of rage and inspiration. Letting that anger drive you towards something rather than shrinking away from it because women aren't supposed to be angry. People aren't going to like us. We're going to be too shrill. But rather saying, hey, you know what? Lean in.
Yes, of course, that's it.
Take that ragepiration. And explore it.
I am mad.
See what's there and what really is driving you so mad.
You, who the devil are you?
From there, kind of figuring out what you can do with it. But I feel like so much of women's history is really just layers upon layers of rage, spiration, building and building over time.
Because I am mad, I hate you.
Yeah, one of my favorite little bits of rage-spiration is the fact that whether you're looking at politics, business, school, whatever, men, even if they are unprepared or untrained in whatever the field may be, are way more likely to still step up and apply for the job or apply for the promotion. Women are less likely to step forward and go for that job or whatever because they feel like, oh, well, I'm not literally 100% filling out every bullet point that is requested in this job listing.
You're afraid you're going out of your mind. Well, I'm here to prove to you that you're not.
One go-to piece of advice that usually resonates is, well, just ask yourself, what would an overly confident white man do?
Yeah.
And go from there.
Yeah. I've had enough.
The gas just went down.
You saw that too?
Why, yes.
Kristen Conger and Caroline Irvin, with editorial commentary from Ingrid Bergman, Charles Boyer, and Flamingo Shadow. Kristen and Caroline host Unladylike, the podcast, which is now also a book. Coming up, neuroscientist Richard Davidson has a different prescription for simmering rage. Melt it down. Turn it into love. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We'll be right back. We've been talking about the benefits of getting angry and about using it to spark some change. Well, neuroscientist Richard Davidson has a different take.
It's not as useful as we may think.
Davidson founded and runs the Center for Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's a global leader on the subject of emotional well-being. He's also a friend and confidant of the Dalai Lama, and he told Steve Paulson that he has come to believe that anger is fundamentally destructive.
I think that particularly in today's climate, where there is a gaping lack of civility, anger exacerbates that. I certainly understand why victimized groups become angry. It's not unreasonable for them to become angry. But the question is whether it is skillful in helping to actually resolve the situation and improve it.
Let me turn this more personally to your own history, because I've heard you talk about back in the 60s and 70s when you were a political activist. You were out there marching against the Vietnam War, and it's hard to imagine protests against something like that that are not motivated, not born out of anger in some
way.
Well,
I was definitely angry in those days, no question about it. So, absolutely. And I think that they're probably, in hindsight, there might have been more skillful ways of protesting. There's a kind of moral outrage, if you will, or moral indignation, which can occur without all of the accompaniments of anger. We see beautiful examples of that in extraordinary leaders, such as Martin Luther King, Gandhi, Nelson Mandela. In the contemporary world, I had the honor of spending some time about a year ago with John Lewis, the African-American congressman from Georgia, who was part of the civil rights movement in the 60s. And John was imprisoned for more than 6 months for going into an all-white bathroom in Alabama.
And beaten badly and beaten in the March on Selma.
Yes. John Lewis has zero anger. I mean, absolutely none. Not in any morsel of his body.
But was he angry back then? Is that partly what motivated him to be able to do all of that?
I don't know. I can't really answer that. But I can tell you today, he is filled with love. And he's still a member of the U.S. Congress. And that can't be an easy job these days.
When you say he's filled with love, how did you see that?
You can feel it. You can feel that even for his ideologically opposite adversaries in the United States Congress, he can see their humanity as people, and he can love them as a human being while strongly disagreeing with them, but it's not anger. And I think that the way he responds is so different because of that. Now, that takes work. You know, you can't just tell a person, give up anger and fill yourself with love. That's not going to work. It's highly impractical.
Does it work if only one side shows compassion and the other side remains angry?
It's got to start somewhere. So one side needs to be courageous.
So to go back to your own experience then, protesting against the Vietnam War, I mean, you said you were really angry back then, but it sounds like you're saying that if you could do it over again, you would have done it differently?
Yes, I would have done it differently. And I was definitely an angrier person then. I was, you know, not just angry about the Vietnam War. I was more volatile in my daily life. You know, not that I was ever an excessively angry person, but I definitely lost it at work, you know, a few times a week. That just, you know, that doesn't happen anymore. It was a gradual change that took decades.
And you've had a decades-long practice of meditation, I know.
Yes. You know, I certainly attribute my practice to being a big part of this.
This is something that I struggle with as I think about it. I mean, a movement like the protest against the Vietnam War, I mean, how could that movement take shape? How could it mobilize people without anger sort of driving people to do that? What you might call justified anger.
Well, you know, screaming at your enemy is just, it's not going to lead to very much productive change. While it is righteous anger in some sense, and certainly completely understandable, it's just not clear to me what beneficial impact that's going to have other than to perhaps give the person who's expressing the anger some sense of satisfaction at having unleashed and let off some steam about this. I mean, when we are on the other side of the receiving end of it, it certainly doesn't feel good.
Right.
It leads to a kind of defensive posture.
Speaking of your own personal history, I know you have spent a lot of time, a lot of years, working with Tibetan Buddhists, and you've gotten to know the Dalai Lama quite well. If there's anyone who has a right to be angry, it's the Dalai Lama. I mean, forced out of his native Tibet, demonized by the Chinese authorities, his country has been taken away. Is he angry?
Not about that. I've never seen him angry about the Tibet situation.
Really?
I've seen him very sad. I've seen him cry on many occasions. I have seen him angry a few times, very rarely, but I've seen him get angry for a very short period of time.
What, like a few minutes?
No, a few seconds. I mean, but there was real anger there for a few seconds. Huh. I've seen him, you know, just flare very transiently. And then what's so unusual about the Dalai Lama is that in one particular episode that I have a very clear memory of, he became angry because someone did something that was not appropriate. And then just literally a couple of seconds later, he noticed on the person who committed this action that he clearly disapproved of, he noticed something funny about what they were wearing, and he just burst out laughing.
So basically, he obviously recognizes that he's angry, but he's immediately able to control it.
Well, I would say that it's not control in that case. It's purely spontaneously being in the moment. So it's not that he's suppressing the anger. The anger arises, and then it naturally dissipates, and then he's in the next moment. There's no spillover from one moment to the next.
Are you surprised that he's not angry about what China has done to Tibet?
No. No, I'm not surprised. One of the stories that he likes to tell is about a Tibetan monk who is imprisoned in a Chinese jail and escaped after some period of time and came over the border, and the Dalai Lama interviewed him and asked him, was there any point during your imprisonment when you were afraid? And this monk said, yeah, there were a couple of times when I really was afraid. I was afraid when I was beginning to lose my compassion for my captors.
I mean, these seem like superhuman people who can respond to a situation like that.
I mean, what's amazing is that they're really not. They're very ordinary in many ways. However, there are two things. One is they've been living in a culture from birth where these values are imbued. And the second is that they practice training their mind starting early in childhood.
Hmm. Let me ask you about an interview that we heard earlier in the show. We talked with Rebecca Traister, who's just written a book about women's anger, and she has a very different take. She says that women constantly get the message that their anger is ugly or shameful, so they bottle it up, and it often leads to depression. And she realized that anger has value, and once she realized that, she felt better physically and emotionally. She slept better. She said she had better sex with her husband. She felt validated, and she felt relief and almost exhilaration at times. So her advice is, especially for women, to let it out, to feel it, to say it, to integrate it into your life. Does that make sense to you?
In part, yes. I think that it's very toxic to bottle up anger. So that if you're experiencing anger, trying to actively suppress it, I think, is very unhealthy. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that. So I would say that her perspective on that is very consistent with scientific evidence. There are other ways to transform anger rather than bottling it.
How do you transform it?
Years of practice.
Practice, you mean you're talking about mindfulness kind
of
practice?
Well, awareness, compassion, training the mind to cultivate more virtuous qualities. I think it's possible to transform anger, but not by bottling it.
So love the person who is furious at you, if you can.
And in most cases, you can't. And so this is not a something you can simply tell a person. And I recognize that even the thought of this is so upsetting to some people, because there is a kind of righteous indignation with acts that are committed that are morally inappropriate. And so it's really important for this not to be misinterpreted. You can't just tell a person to love. If they don't have the mental wherewithal to love, you can't tell them to love. You have to create the causes and conditions that allow love to arise.
So one final question. This is really hard work to develop this compassion. I mean, not just as sort of an idea, but to really sort of take it in and, you know, to have this kind of love that you're talking about. How do you get there? What kind of practice can help you become that person?
I see this, Steve, as an urgent public health need. And this is really about caring for our mind. And even if we spend a few minutes every day intentionally caring for our mind in this way, by developing these positive qualities and doing it every day, year in, year out.
You're talking about meditation?
Yeah, different kinds of meditation to cultivate kindness, to cultivate gratitude, to cultivate compassion. The world would be a different place. You know, we've published data in a randomized controlled trial showing that as little as 7 total hours of practice across several weeks is sufficient to change the brain. And once people begin to taste the qualities that arise when you do this, I think they're going to want to do it more. And so I see us moving toward a tipping point. In the United States today, we've really done a good job in tremendously decreasing the percentage of people who smoke in the population, right, as a public health campaign. I mean, if you go back to 1950 and compare it today, it's dramatic. We need to do the same thing for caring for our mind.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Neuroscientist Richard Davidson. He directs the Center for Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also the co-author with Dan Goleman of the book Altered Traits. Coming up, writer Alice Walker has been thinking about how anger can coexist with peace. She wrote this poem about the late boxer Muhammad Ali, a fighter who was also a pacifist.
And now we're ready for the fight of the century. Hundreds of millions are seeing this bout around the world. Muhammad Ali and the Red Trunks, Joe Frazier.
The long road home for Muhammad Ali.
Muhammad Ali just punched the jab.
I am beginning to comprehend the mystery of the gift of suffering.
Ali covering up on the ropes.
It is true, as some have said, that it is a crucible in which the gold of one's spirit is rendered and shines.
Muhammad Ali saved the world.
Ali, you represent all of us who stand the test of suffering, most often alone, because who can understand who or what has brought us to our feet? Their knees worn out, ancestors stood us up from the awkward position they had to honor on the floor, beneath the floor. I have been weeping all day thinking of this. The cloud of witness, the endless teaching.
Look for a last-minute flurry by Muhammad Ali.
The long road home.
Alice Walker talks about anger, compassion, and she'll read more poetry after this. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
Thank you.
No person is your friend who demands your silence or denies your right to grow. That's one of my favorite quotations from Alice Walker, the author of The Color Purple, Meridian, In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, so many more. I think of her by now as not only a writer, but also a wise woman. Shannon Henry Kleiber sat down with her recently to talk about her new book of poems. It's called Taking the Arrow Out of the Heart, and also about how she works on healing herself when she's been hurt by others.
Alice, we are living in a time when so many of us are angry. I wanted to ask you about how you feel about that. Is anger useful? Is anger constructive? How do you use anger in your life?
Well, anger is awakening, which is very good. It's a fuel that can be used for creativity and all kinds of other things. I think people might find it useful to figure out a way to channel it into the circle of people who you need to change things. You know, find those people. Let your anger guide you away from what is dangerous and perilous and toward what is useful. And I would recommend for people to acknowledge their anger and be in circle about their anger. We can't really get rid of it. We just have to use it for something positive and something that doesn't hurt us.
The title of your most recent book, Taking the Arrow Out of the Heart, is that about anger? Is that about using things for good? Tell me how you came up with that title.
Well, I was suffering very much from dissolving a marriage with someone I really loved many years ago, and nothing saved me from despair but meditation. So I learned how to do meditation in the 70s, I think it was. But then again, I fell in love many years later, and trying to deal with the pain of that led me to a Buddhist nun whose name is Pema Chodron, who has done incredible work in teaching some ancient Tibetan practices about freeing your heart. One of them, very briefly, is to learn how to acknowledge the arrow that is in your heart, whether it's from, you know, romantic love or dissolving of a marriage or a family, or whether it's whatever it is. Could be the horrible leadership we have in the country. But whatever it is, we acknowledge that we are suffering and the arrow has landed in our hearts. What many people do is they spend most of their time yelling at the person who shot the arrow and very little time trying to get the arrow out. And if you don't get the arrow out, then it festers and it turns against you. So the practice from these ancient Tibetans is that you learn, you actually train to take care of your own heart and to get the arrow out. And then you can begin to, you know, or maybe even simultaneously, you can work against the archer. But it's futile to go after the archer without tending to your own wound.
So it's a lot about taking care of yourself.
Very much so, but in a not so simple way, because mm-hmm. the practice like this, it has a name and it has, you know, all the other things. It's actually called Lojong. The practice of bringing in and taking out is called Tonglin. And basically, it's this way of taking in the arrow, knowing the arrow is there, breathing it in. And this is, of course, not just in one sitting, but in many sittings. And then breathing out what you'd rather have, which would be beneficial to you. And then the huge learning, teaching and learning for Americans especially, would be to learn to breathe out goodness that you want for yourself, for everyone. Because our primary problem in our country is greed and the inability to share with other people. And this is an arrow that has just undermined the republic forever.
That's a powerful way of thinking about anger, that somebody is angry at you and shooting you, and you, instead of fighting against them, kind of stop and say, I need to tend to myself. I need to not bleed to death. Are we able to do that?
Of course
we
are.
What needs to happen to encourage that more? Yeah, because we do. Someone shoots us, we do get angry.
Right.
So how do we change that?
Well, I was thinking about this morning, you know, as I go along with this book and I'm talking to people about these practices, and I thought, oh, but you have to tell them that they have to spend time to do this. It's not like they can do it once and it's you know, it took me a year, basically, to take out a particular arrow. But I was determined that I did not want to have it. And I also did not want to harm anyone, including the archer, basically. But yeah, you really have to learn. It's work. And that's, again, one of those areas where in our country, often people really are not prepared to work on themselves. I mean, they can work a lot about this or that, but when it comes to working on the self, distraction is a big magnet.
I wanted to ask you to read this poem here, To Be a Woman.
Oh, yes. To be a woman does not mean to wear a shroud. The feminine is not dead, nor is she sleeping. Angry, yes. Seething, yes. Biding her time, yes, yes.
Wow. What were you thinking when you wrote that poem?
Well, that the feminine is awake, but not awake enough. And she is awakening. She's very angry, and she's really been very, very hurt. I mean, talk about an arrow in the heart. The feminine has, you know, pretty much since the patriarchy started, had a huge arrow in her heart. And she has suffered all these centuries and millennia trying to really appease the archer. And that hasn't worked at all. She's just become more degraded. So now her anger should allow her to gather with her sisters to make this circle, and some men too, actually, and her young sons. She can make this circle and begin to, you know, acknowledge her anger and deal with the fact that we need to change things and to be very strategic about doing that.
What can we do to make that better?
Well, it's up to women to realize that they are not free, to really, you know, work really hard with other women to be free, and also to understand that they are a global tribe, just as children are a global tribe. You have to recognize that you belong to all the women of the world. You don't just belong to the women in your neighborhood and your town. Mm-hmm. And that's the beginning of a mighty power that women have denied themselves because they bought into the notion of being really a part of this or that male republic, mm-hmm. you know, which has nothing to do with their freedom.
Women need to help other women.
Well, yeah, but it's not so simple. I mean, it's like women think they are helping other women. Right. You know, they bake some food and take it and all, that's wonderful. But I'm saying at a deep level, women have to understand that they are a tribe of women on the globe.
Together.
Together.
What really drives you right now to keep writing poetry?
Oh, the world is full of everything to drive everybody. I mean, mm-hmm. we should all be writing poems. It's a time of incredible sadness, which is rich ground for poetry. It's a time of rage. It's a time of frustration and despair and heartbreak and sorrow and the sense that the earth has turned against us finally for being so abusive of her. For me, by now, it's between writing poetry just because I'm a poet, but also just dancing. Because, you know, it's better to be doing some dancing almost than complaining because we've turned. It has turned. And there are no longer any golden countries left. This one certainly isn't. I think it's a good time for all of us to offer what we have in the way of, my parents would call it, salvation. Mm-hmm. And I do think you cannot go wrong with having more silence in your life, more meditation. Beginning to really understand from deep within yourself who you are and what you're about and how to channel your anger.
Mm-hmm. Alice Walker. She won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award for The Color Purple. And she and Shannon Henry Kleiber were talking about her new book of poems called Taking the Arrow Out of the Heart. The conversation was recorded in the beautiful Northwood studios of Interlochen Public Radio in Traverse City, Michigan. And because we began this hour talking about women's anger, let's end it with Alice's poem, I Believe the Women.
I believe the women. Whatever the reason for their delay in coming forth,
I believe they would not come forward now except to feel sane and clean again. Sisters, keep your heads up. I also feel compassion for the old man. How can I not? I love old men, partly because it takes so long for them to awaken to themselves. The selves they hid are put to sleep when they were 5 or even younger. Who knows what happens to misalign a soul? We can grow from this if we try. It is not the end of the world. What other people think of us should be our last concern. It has always been what we think of ourselves that matters. When we have hurt others, no matter our reason, maturity demands we own up, go to them, say, "I am sorry, and will you forgive me?" Most people don't believe in this, and that is why the world is out of control. You have lost a beloved idol, precious to you. How will you make it without your belief? I would walk on my knees over pebbles to unbreak your heart. But that is magic none of us can do.
This hour of To the Best of Our Knowledge was produced by Shannon Henry Kleiber, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers, and Angelo Batista. Our sound designer and technical director is Joe Hartke. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strangechamps. And just remember, if you're feeling angry, you're not alone. We're all in this together. Thanks for listening.